I started here last week in this chapter and basically went through the first four verses, which I'd like to read again and then proceed from there. Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, verse 2, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us when these things will be. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." And before I go further, I'm going to just say a couple of things that I said from there last week. And Jesus, it seems like, what really happens here in the context is he's just gotten through a time of a long discourse or a long section, a long talk in a matter of saying on his, in a sense, I'm going to call it rejection of his own, because his own rejected him. Okay, he came unto his own and his own received him not. Now, he's been through quite an ordeal and quite a battle in life with the religious people who had turned the entire faith of the Jewish people and nation, all of that, into something God didn't intend. And it was like God was no longer part of it, only except to continue on with the people. Well, Jesus now is here on the scene. He's been rejected by his own. That's been coming for some time. And what he really confirms now is his rejection of them. Basically saying, and not in a nasty way at all, in a very sad way, saying, "You've had your opportunity. You knew not the day of your visitation. When God himself came to you. When the Messiah that you've waited for a long while has arrived." And I think we find Jesus basically right on the Mount of Olives. Let me say again that that's why this is called the Olivet Discourse. Let me say again that it's happening in the final week of Jesus' life on earth. Let me say again that it's like a final teaching that he shares in this final week of his life. And let me say again that it's basically saying, I find it interesting, I should say, that he has to dwell on this matter of the end times and the precious little time he has with them, and he considers it of vital importance that he tell the disciples what is yet forthcoming for the Jewish people because of their rejection of him. And in a matter of speaking, God and Jesus' rejection, which is one and the same being, person, of them for their rejection of him. And say that what I'm going to do, it's like Jesus saying, if I dare represent it, paraphrasing him, saying, I'm going to reach back for a lesson in so-called recent history to tell you how that says something about the routine history that will be on this earth from way back then until when, meaning the end, until the time also in revealed history, Jesus prophesying. After all, that's what revealed, that's what history is. It's a prophecy is telling history in advance, because what God says will come, will come. If there's nothing else to be said and affirmed and understood about prophecy, and Jesus is here making the most important prophecy and teaching on the most important, some of the most important prophetic teaching we can have in all of the Word of God. It's coming from the Son of God. Why wouldn't it be? Saying, I'm making known to you what yet comes, based on what, based on past history and present activity, even with me coming, Jesus speaking, and you rejecting me, right, in a sense, face to face. and what will come because of that, and what will come after that same pattern. That's what he's going to make known for us in the Olivet Discourse. But let me say this. For instance, I say recent history now. That's talking about in God's time and going back 600 and 700 years. And a lot further than that, but even to the certain prophets that are alluded to here. And saying with, for instance, Ezekiel. I told the story last week, which Ezekiel tells the story of the departure, catch this, the departure of the glory of God from the temple because it's about to be destroyed. And in a matter of speaking, God isn't going to be in there. He's indestructible. When the temple is destroyed, when the nation falls, because of their disobedience and rebellion and judgment come because of that, and God remove himself from that, see? As much as to say, it's happening now again, and Jesus telling this information, sitting on the Mount of Olives, which is like being up here on this mountain, overlooking the temple complex, the most magnificent worship building, and one of the most magnificent buildings, period, ever constructed. And not only all that, but the notion going along with it, we're God's chosen. He's not going to touch us. He's not going to touch the temple. He's not going to destroy it. He's not going to bring ruination to this nation of rebellion in spite of all the rebellion and rejection. All of this is involved here, okay? All of this is involved here. And we have to have that solidly in mind to be able to get anywhere with what we're being told about end time destruction, which is also patterned after these previous times when there was the destruction of the temple the first time, 600 and 700 years before, when Ezekiel saw the removal of the Spirit of God in visionary, sort of like spiritual insight and vision. And it's going to happen again, Jesus says, as he sits right there on the Mount of Olives overlooking the temple complex and saying, it's going to fall. It's going to fall big. And was it correct? Whatever. Our history will tell us that 40 years later, in fact, just shy of that, it fell. Jesus says, based on that past example, Jesus says, based on this present example, in terms of me sitting here in the flesh, rejected, being received only by those who are followers, and they greatly misunderstanding this until a little more of the drama goes on from here, and saying it's not only then, this is the whole point, okay? It's not only then, and it's not only now, but those will tell us and inform us about what's yet to come at the end of the age. Again, the disciples' question, tell us when these things will be. You're talking about the fall of the temple. And I can imagine the disciples were asking in very, sarcastic or something sort of way, saying it isn't going to happen. What are you talking about, Jesus? It took, years and years to construct this temple, and it's going to be torn down. It's not going to happen. Jesus said it's going to happen. And it not only happened that time, and Jesus, before he's done telling about how it's going to now be destroyed, as it was in the past, as it will happen now in the present, in a matter of speaking, in this generation, 40 years from now or whatever, it's going to happen again after that. The fall of the nation and all this and that. But let me say this. Just thinking of Ezekiel alone and every single prophet that came before Christ could be referenced in any number of details with this. But Ezekiel, he ministered during a time of upheaval and upheaval, national and international. Today. And his message in that case with Ezekiel focuses uniquely on Israel. Let's say number three, that we're talking about a holy people. We're talking about a holy temple, a holy city, a holy land, a holy nation, supposedly. That's what it was intended to be. But let's go on immediately to say, after reading a whole lot of the rest of the Old Testament, and before coming to Ezekiel, we're talking about a people, I'm just going to word it this way, made very unholy. making the temple very unholy, making the land very unholy, and making the city, capital city of God's kingdom on earth, mind you, not only past and not only present as Jesus talks about it, but yet in future. The Bible presents, per se, Jerusalem in all its glory in the future to be nothing other than the capital of God's kingdom on earth. Millennium and everything else included, see? He's not through with Jerusalem. He's not through with the nation. He's not through with the people. He's not through with the temple. Now, in the sense of getting through with the temple and the city, the walls fell and all that, whatever, people carried into exile, ruination of the nation. And he said, sad part of it is, disciples, we didn't learn from that. This generation has not learned from that. It's coming again. Sadder part yet, that it will not only happen again, but it will happen yet again. And that's before us in this day. Now, that's what Jesus is talking about here. And the defiling, again, of the nation, the city, capital, the people, the religion, the temple. All of it. Gone on long enough and is extensive enough and severe enough that destruction once again, judgment, will visit this nation, this people. But from such defilement, that's still not the final chapter. God, although, yeah, from such defilement back then, God will withdraw. It's so significant, the removal of the Spirit of God, of his presence, from the temple. And Ezekiel gives us detail enough to say that there was a time he sat on the Mount of Olives before making total departure from the nation and resided there, or I mean, sat there per se and observed the happenings for a while. The very place, very likely, where Jesus is now making his observations from and is sharing his teaching. And saying, that temple I visited, that temple now, the rebuilt one, that I attempted to purge or purify or cleanse, and it did no good. And basically saying to the Jewish people, and he said it to them, your house is left to you desolate. The Spirit of Jesus, the Spirit of God, as in Ezekiel's time, as in now at the Olivet time, has departed. And when God withdraws his Spirit from that temple, from that city, from that nation, from that people, and when God withdraws his Spirit from our nation, we know that it's a sad picture. I could go on with that for a long while, but I'm going here and say it's still not, from such defilement God will withdraw himself. It's still not the final chapter here. God's, listen to this. God's faithfulness to his covenant, the covenant made with his people, the covenant his people bought into and agreed to, the covenant made with his people, and his desire to save is so great that he will reverse again all that was reversed. It was set up this way and turned from very holy to unholy. And it's now going to do this full sweep, 360, and God restore everything. He would receive his people. He would shepherd them with compassion. He will cleanse them from defilement. He will reconstitute his kingdom. And he will overwhelm the forces that are arrayed against those who are his own. Today, every one of those things will apply. Every one of those things will apply. And he will restore the glory of his presence. Just like the book of Ezekiel, the time of destruction and damnation, time of the ruination of the nation, the time of the ruination of the temple. That book did not close with the promise that again, it will all be reversed and God's glory will be restored to the temple. Same today. Well, let me go here. As we read further in Matthew 24, we come to this. Jesus answered them, verse 4. He said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. All right. There's two to what? Let me go on. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled for all. For all these things must come to pass, excuse me, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. And we're talking about famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places, and all these are the beginning of sorrows. Are we having that today? Do we have volcanoes in the, earthquakes in the news today? Do we understand, and I don't have the statistics for that either, just how much stepped up this is? And Jesus was talking in this case about routine history. He didn't say, now look, this is going to start up in the end times. He said this will increase as the times move toward the end. It will always, it's routine history. But in Jesus talking about revealed history, he says, watch for it to step up. Just like, and he compares it to labor pains. They start at such and such a time, but the closer we get to the actual, I'm going to say delivery, the more they intensify, the more they increase. Boy, do I know what that's like. That's not funny. But we go on. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. And you will be hated. You'll be hated by all the nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Oh, there's three. Well, three what? Oh, give me a minute here. You already know. Who has the answer to that? And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. And then the end will come. Now, I said there's three. Let me give you four. Let me give you the fourth one, verse 24. And this is the fourth clue to the fourth occurrence of this. Or false Christ, and he's repeating now in a little different way. But I'm driving this point so that we get the main concern that was Jesus' main concern to really dwell on in his final teaching, the final week of his life. That's verse 24. False Christ, false prophets will rise, show great signs and wonders to what? Deceive. I find it interesting, and that's the core of this message today. To you, I find it interesting that Jesus makes a point to make quite a deal of the fact that in the last times, the main thing I want you to look out for, of all he could have said, of all he might have predicted, of all he might have taught on, of all he could have been concerned about and had to be concerned about, you will be deceived. And that's the spirit of our time and our age, people. But let me say a couple things from a couple different directions and then come back, say more on that. Number one, again, I just observed this from these passages right here and some couple notes of clarification before I say some more. Jesus standing on the Mount of Olives, exactly the place where Zechariah, okay, another prophet, back up to the end of the Old Testament, and he's very close to there. Zechariah, the only prophet yet, follow him up to close the Old Testament is Malachi. That's that close. Yeah, there were 400 years between the Old Testament closing and the New Testament opening, beginning. The very place, though, where Zechariah prophesied, where Zechariah said that the Messiah will come. We're waiting for him. We're looking. We've been anticipating for a long while. And no, it's not going to happen tomorrow, 400 years later, before he shows up, and then as a baby. But at any rate, Zechariah being clear in his prophecy that the place where Messiah is now standing and sharing this Olivet discourse is the very place, Mount Olivet, I tried to say it both ways, and didn't get either one, but where Zechariah predicted that the Messiah would stand when he came to establish his kingdom. How well do these disciples know their Old Testament? Did Jesus say it to them to make it known to them or to catch them up on the fact in a way of saying it? Remember, you know, Zechariah's teaching? Now, if you know your scriptures, he could have said to them, you go back 4 centuries, yeah, it's gone back that far. That's recent history in God's economy. And says, the Messiah is going to do exactly what you're doing, Jesus. How well did the religious people know their Old Testaments, like they claimed to, so that when they saw Jesus doing what Zechariah said the Messiah was doing, that they connected to and understand that the Messiah is making a very clear statement here? I don't know. But it's a fitting place for the disciples to ask Jesus, when and what? So, you know, we've covered that question many times. It's what Jesus said, what Jesus is addressing and what he's answering. But he pointed out in his answer, which is what we're covering, he pointed out in his answer that to his disciples that they should be less concerned with knowing the exact date and very concerned with one thing, which is what our concern is, and to look at the Olivet Discourse and teaching in Revelation and all other prophetic matters, be prepared. Be waiting. Be watching. Be ready. He doesn't say figure out all the details and get them to fit together ever so neat and tidy. Have a general understanding of some of the general gist of some of the, you know, general picture here and so on. But then, you know, the important thing is we had a wonderful talk, a wonderful message on Friday night at the Carinet Banquet. A person who basically says, a lot of it was what I think the heartbeat, and I haven't really gotten to that yet of today's message, is, which I was going to share last week, and I only got 4 verses into it, whatever, and then going few more verses yet, a couple more installments on just one chapter. Endure. This gal said it like this, you know, one picture said it many ways, but get off the 50-yard line, get out there and do something that counts for the game in the future, in the ministry that the world so desperately needs in so many ways, including the saving of babies, which our nation glories in killing off. Well, I held myself back. I have too many directions I'd like to go. But also, this number, a second clarification I'd like to make here is that Jesus' response, I've already hinted at that, come to that. Jesus' response was, first and foremost, okay, in answer to their question and inquiry, take heed that no one deceive you. We have no idea in our time and day and age and nation the extent to which we are being deceived by our leaders in our nation and in our churches. We have no idea. We have no idea. We have no idea. And I said nation, and I said churches. Leaders in both. That's a whole other topic. It's related to this. And we'll be going there in a lot of different ways, which we always have. I understand that. Probably you think, you know, I got one tune on my fiddle. Well, if that's the only tune I can have on my fiddle and so on, I will play it. But number three, let it also be said that the Old Testament frequently mentions prophets and they claimed to receive messages from God, but preached a message that wasn't from God. Same as is happening today, and that's part of the deception. But the popular leaders who tell people what they want to hear. Our churches are full of them. Across the nation. Anyway, I still go on. Jesus said false teachers would come, and he warned his disciples, and he warns us to not listen to their dangerous words. How do we know what's false, what's counterfeit, what's dangerous? Only going by the standard. Only that. It's only way. And, you know, you may get tired of hearing me say, you know, the Bible reading, Bible study, so essential, so totally necessary, so critical. And push it, hammer it, push it, hammer it. It's the only thing we have to go on, people of God. It's the only thing we have to go on. From the U.S. Treasury, you've heard it many times, they'll teach people to identify, say, the best method and strategy for identifying fake money is to study the real, not the, all the fake, all the, because there's any number and versions and ways counterfeit can come out. You have to study the real thing, and then when you look at the counterfeit, say it's not the real. That's this. Okay. Jesus predicted, number four, that his followers would be severely persecuted by those who hated what he stood for. The Bible hated what God stood for long before Jesus visited earth in the flesh. The Bible hated what God and Jesus stood for when God visited in the flesh through Jesus. And the Bible hates, the population hates what God, what believers stand for long after Jesus left the earth, but is still present to guide people who will live by the word of God. And when you're pressured to give up, this is going back to the message at Karenet. When you're pressured to give up, and when you're pressured to turn your back on Christ, and when you're pressured to forsake anything and everything that God has for us, and all things, all matter, related to everything of life, everything, all things, remember the benefits of standing firm and continue thereby to live for Christ. That's the message for today. Now, I'm just going to push that out a little further here for being done. And that's to say this. The major sign, the disciples said, I go back to their question, tell us when these things will be, tell us what will be the signs of your, tell us what will be the signs of the end of the age. And his number one sign, main response, in a matter of a few verses, repeated four times, watch out. Watch out that you be not deceived. Jesus was painfully clear on one thing. He was painfully clear on many things. But because he was so painfully clear on this one thing, we ought to be able to at least be very clear on this, even if we find some other things pretty foggy. And I'm pushing that again to say basically this. What will be the main? Religious deception will be rampant. It's here today. It's here with us. The false and the counterfeit just be rampant. The counterfeit revelation will conflict with the revealed word. And protection from deception is found, and I repeat, already said it, I'll drive that point too, enduring faith in Jesus Christ, an absolute authority of the word, and a thorough knowledge of that truth. Nothing else will do. Nothing else will safeguard. Nothing else. Okay. In verse 13, Paul says, Jesus says this, and we are here. If we heard no other words from even this short section of the chapter, verses 1 through 14, just really, this one, he who endures to the end shall be saved. He who endures to the end. And you know, that doesn't happen just now. That was for Jesus' disciples even then. You know, when you think about the disciples, they don't know a lot of this that's before them, neither do we. Jesus made it known to them. They didn't get it, neither do we. Jesus made a lot known to us of what will yet come, and we don't get it in a lot of things, a lot of ways, any better than the disciples did. But they didn't know, in a sense, that even this was Jesus' final week. He told them. He's talking to them about these events to come in the future. And they asked him. They said, give us sign, give us instruction, give us teaching, give us pointers here. And it's his last week. Even though being told that, they thought, no, not really. The temple's going to be destroyed. No, not really. And there's plenty of other signs and plenty of other things to look out for, and false Christs and counterfeit teaching. And it's like, no, not really. And Jesus has said even, remember, we've said before that when the disciples even came and asked him about this, he just spent a number of times, in teachings, in a matter of saying, in talks, telling them, it's in a sense, all is lost. Not only the temple's going to fall, the city, and the whole Jewish religion and nations. No, not really. Just like back with the prophets, at the first time the city fell, the first time the temple was destroyed. No, it's not going to happen. God sent prophets. God never sends judgment without sharing warning. And in most cases, we're not talking a single warning. We're talking warning after warning after warning, one person after another, in a sense, one generation after another, warning, 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 warning. No, it's not going to be the way God said. Yes, it's going to be the way God said. That's repeated itself a number of times through history. It's going to repeat itself again in our history. That people are going to say it's not what the way God says it. And when the dust settles and the final chapter is written, it's going to be just the way God said it. We need to understand that. I wish we could grasp that. I wish we would affirm that with a certainty that will not be tampered with nor reversed. The point being, even here, when they asked, the temple, you've just spent some time denouncing that. See, if we study and grasp what led up to the disciples' question and the location on the Mount of Olives, where Jesus, by the way, not only taught this information, but also Mount of Olives, where he ascended from, and Mount of Olives, where he will return to that very spot when he returns again. See, Mount of Olives, a very important time in his life and ministry. And they're saying, you spent this time denouncing the temple. Now, surely, there's got to be something good about it, Lord. Just look magnificent. I mean, so much of the fixings were gold-plated. And what wasn't gold-plated was basically construction of marble. And it was a massive thing. And I still didn't do that this week to bring even a picture that shows an overlook of the temple and just a gigantic complex. We have no perception of that. That if you put people in the courts and in the temple, corridors and so on, they look like little fly specks, so that you get that, relative sort of like, it was that big. We ought to measure out, the dimensions of the temple itself as well as some of the city, and then sort of place it on a grid here. And I don't mean a grid, I mean one that we can see with our eyes and say, the temple would spread from here to the whatever, out from, Doesn't matter. It was just that magnificent. And it was that certain in a matter of saying it, like the disciples saying, it's just it's not going to happen. Well, Jesus said, it will happen. And in a matter of speaking, when he says the details that he does, again, like going back to prophets of old and say, listen, the same thing that's happening here in terms of your misunderstanding of it or your resistance to it, the same as has happened through the years. You can go back to Zechariah, you can go back to Ezekiel, we can go back to Jeremiah, the same Jeremiah that it was said. I always say this, I always have to say, I never forget Don Arthur sharing a book with me of Jeremiah, and the key about that book was basically in his ministry was chapter 12, verse 5, at least that book from InterVarsity was built on this idea from chapter 12, verse 5. Jeremiah, God speaking to him, challenging him, trying to comfort him, exhorting him, and saying, Jeremiah, if you're worn out, as the Message translation has it, and in this foot race with mere men, then how will you race with the horses? Say, what in the world does a question have to do with Jeremiah racing with horses? It's a picture of the notion that God telling Jeremiah, I have great things in store for you in terms of a great challenge in ministry. And it's going to be something comparable rather than a race around this track out here with men. It's going to be a race with horses. It's of that sort of like extent and magnitude in a matter of saying it. And he said, I want you to be trained for that. Nobody goes up against any, in any professional sport, whatever thing, or team sport, period, local, national, whatever, Olympics, without training, training, training. God will train his own, and that's what he was saying to Jeremiah. And Jesus is now saying, in comparison with Jeremiah, I think it's very fair to make this parallel. Jesus is saying, what you are being taken through, what you are going through, what you are being instructed in, is the same as basically getting training for what you will face that I know you're going to face, but you don't know what you're going to face. There's a lot of the kicker right there. But contending with horses, that's what's before you, Jeremiah. And Jesus again saying, I see what's coming and I'm preparing you. And Jesus saying, watch that you do not be deceived in what comes up and what you have to face. It's probably going to be so challenging and so stretching in a matter of saying it that, you know, you'll want to duck out on it. But, so, you know, and Jesus in a sense may be saying, if you are not fortified with the truth, with the word of God, with the accurate information, prediction, prophecy of what's coming in the future, you will not be able to endure. You will not be strengthened to endure. And if you do not have the Holy Spirit as your trainer, you might as well throw in the towel, which is a phrase that does come out of the boxing circuit. I always say that, then I say, remember, from what I understand of that phrase and the use of it in the boxing circle, it isn't the boxer who's in the ring duking it out that throws in the towel. If the trainer, coach, or whatever sees that it's, you know, something that should happen now, he's the one throws in the towel. So unless Jesus does that for us, we have no business doing it. We're called to endure. The picture has it that Mama Giraffe, when she gives birth, she does so from a standing position. That means that when baby giraffe is delivered, it has a 10-foot drop to the ground to land on its head. Well, why on earth would that? Yeah. Well, and Mama then does something that absolutely can also be surprising, intrigue you, whatever. After quickly stretching her neck down to check baby's condition, she stands up to swing her front foot a good solid kick to the baby. If it's down, to get it up. If it's up, to knock it down. And she's not done yet. No sooner does baby collapse than Mama winds up her leg and kicks him again. Well, this happens 3 and 4 and 5 more times. Why on earth would a mother do that? Well, baby finally musters enough strength and the adrenaline flowing and terror filling his heart to stand up, and once baby gets up on all fours, Mama again swings her leg and kicks his legs out from under him. And again, the process repeated even in that form, in that cycle, in that level, 2 and 3 and 4 times, I understand. The result is this. Within the first hour of his life, baby learns how to get up quickly and to move away from Mama readily. And then, in a sense, move with Mama just as readily. Why does Mama Giraffe do this? She's trying to be mean. She's instinctively understands this. God designed it this way, too, when you talk about distinction. What's the word I want? Well, know what animals have for instinct. Because giraffes are defenseless. If they cannot move together in a pack. The shooting of the buffaloes this last week or whatever. That's one thing I learned about buffaloes from way back or whatever. When the baby's threatened, you know, they form that circle around it out on the plains and in the wilderness and so on. Protect the instinct that's built into these animals to protect their young. And what we're saying about this mama giraffe somehow getting it, this baby giraffe, as mobile as she can, as fast as she can, as soon as she can. The same thing happens with, even like the hatching of a chick out of an egg shell. Don't help it. The process is what is needed to give that strength, that chick strength, to stand on its own per se when it's, excuse the term, delivered from the eggshell. And the same goes for a butterfly in a cocoon. Don't help it. By helping, we're not helping. That's so much the way it is with a lot of our young people. So many times, so many ways, the ways we want to help aren't any help at all. But because giraffes are defenseless, if they cannot move in a pack, they don't, you know, have the protection that they'll have that way. But it's like what God does for us. He loves you and me enough that even though we misunderstand him and what he's doing, possibly shake our fist right in his face, sometimes perhaps curse him, whatever the case may be, he says, I know this is needed in your life. I know this is what you will have in order for you to be able to stand for the truth, for the right thing. I'm certain of it. Jesus is saying that in his Olivet teaching. He's saying it to his disciples then. What he says to his disciples then is what he says to us now. But that we might be able to run with the horses. In order that we might, whatever other image or picture or analogy or illustration you use, but one word, endure. If there's one word to Jesus' message in this section of it, just basically verses 1 to 14, first concern, first answer, first response, repeated in a number of ways, endure, endure. Whatever comes, and it's not going to be nice, it's not going to be pretty, but I think of Moses also, just one last thing yet. Moses, 40 years of age, who said, if you want to look at Hebrews there in chapter 11, go there for a moment, said, I'd rather be with God's people and suffer than remain in this place where the pleasures of sin are but for a season. Moses, who was in line to, you know, basically circulate in the court of the most powerful government in the world of that time. Moses, who forsook all that. And Hebrews 11 in the New Testament, some writer here, and it's certain, it's the only book in the New Testament that's not certainty who wrote it. That doesn't matter. The Holy Spirit wrote it, but preaching a sermon and teaching a lesson and plenty of lessons on how the people of God live and walk and serve and minister and endure by faith. Verse 23 says, by faith, when he was born, or so like some will say, his parents, by an act of faith, because they saw he was a beautiful child, they're not afraid of the king's command. The king's command said, kill all babies. This gal, by the way, comes to mind just like that, flashes in my mind. Friday night, she says that I think it was her second child, this diagnosis was made, you give up the child or you go blind. Almost sounds like a joke, but whatever the condition was, and the doctor came in and said that, he says, now, you have a choice to make. And she says, the choice is already made. The child will basically live. She claims that he slammed shut the folder or whatever he had and walked out and left her sit there. Nice. It's a real medical professional. He says, you're a fool. That's a foolish decision. Well, I guess Moses' parents made a very foolish decision. By faith, a lot of people in Scripture, Old and New Testament, and ever since, including the Now Testament, including that example I just mentioned. People making foolish decisions. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He wasn't going to be considered a prince in the most powerful court of the day of the world. choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. What does that say to us today who want to follow, who want to believe, who want to endure? Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than the riches of Egypt. I'm going to read some of that again and just let it speak for itself from the Amplified Version. Moses, grown to maturity, became great, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter because he preferred to share the oppression, suffer the hardships, bear the shame of the people of God rather than to have the fleeting enjoyment of a sinful life. That's for you and I today, folks. The challenge is the same. It hasn't changed. The invitation is the same. He considered the contempt and abuse and shame born for Christ, the Messiah who was to come, all of that's in there, to say, to be greater wealth than all the treasures that Egypt had to offer. The most powerful materialistic nation of the world of that time. And motivated by faith, verse 27, he left all that behind, being unawed and undismayed by the wrath of the king. He never flinched, but held staunchly to his purpose and endured steadfastly as one who gazed on him who is invisible. By faith and by simple trust and by confidence in God, he instituted and carried out the sprinkling of the blood on the doorposts of the houses that would be a sign of deliverance and protection for the inhabitants of that house. Gives real thrust and meaning to the phrase under the blood. And they were in a very, very literal sense that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch those children of Israel. I'm sorry, I'll share this yet. It's about Winston Churchill. 248 pounds of solid inspiration. He saw England through Germany's Blitzreich, and as the Third Reich dropped thousands of bombs in London, Hitler himself felt, as did other international observers, that England would fall easily. And you know what? If it were still under Neville Chamberlain, and we won't repeat his blunder, it probably would have fallen very easily. But this bulldog of a man, Winston Churchill, went on the air and time again called his nation to hang on and to believe. And England didn't go down. And I have a notion, for as little as I know, that if England had gone down, I think all would have been lost. But years later, one of his alma maters, okay? Years later, one of his alma maters, Winston Churchill, an exclusive prep school that he had attended, of course, asked him to speak at graduation. And when he accepted the invitation, the headmaster of the school was just elated. And for weeks, he told the student body, soon, Winston Churchill is coming. And he said, he's the most powerful orator in history. He's going to speak here. And I want you to bring your pencils and paper and take note of every word he says. And finally, the day came. And the graduation service began. And the students sitting behind the speaker's podium had pencils and paper poised. I'm sure you understand that the speaker, the podium was facing the visitors coming, whatever, and the students were here on stage with him or whatever. And the parents and guests settled in for a long inspirational speech. And after many flowery introductions, Churchill arose, and he took the podium, and he turned around to address the young men behind him. And he said, gentlemen, these are his words, I quote his speech verbatim, gentlemen, never give up, never give up, never, 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 never give up. That was his speech of this most powerful orator in the world at the time, or so he's claimed to be, and he sat down, the students were stunned, the audience was amazed, and none of them ever, ever forgot that. And I know that if Winston Churchill were still alive, you'd like to call him as your pastor and give sermons of that. How many words was that? That's what Jesus says to us. He says, never give up. He that endures to the end shall be saved. Matthew 24. In that case, verse 13 is found there. You know, Jesus wants us to endure. And in order to endure, we have to abide. Now, that go in a whole other direction. Go to John chapter 15 and learn something about that branch and that limb being attached to that branch, to that trunk, that vine, and the sap flowing with a sap of, like, per se, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to write, but without it, you're dead in the water. We cannot endure if we don't abide, and if we don't abide, we won't endure. We will not make it through. And yet, wonderful, wonderful ending to it all. Turn to the last chapter, read the closing of the story of all of this, the story of his story, history, and we win. And we'll sing a song together.
Shepherd looks after me. My name